roll the snowball. The snowball gets bigger and bigger and bigger. And it's true, right? You get that good spring snow. It's kind of wet and definitely sticky. And you know, you make a snowball and you start pushing it on the ground downhill, right? And at first, the snowball isn't very heavy, and it's a lot of friction to pick up all that additional weight of snow. But eventually, it's getting bigger and bigger and bigger, and it starts to roll under its own, you know, weight. And then there's that oh beep moment when you realize that it's not. You can run with it for a while, and maybe you can guide it just slightly. But there's a moment where the thing weighs more than you do as an 8-year-old kid, and only two things are going to govern its fate, which is you know, gravity and whatever car or house or people are down at the bottom of the hill. And the interest rate is like that. So what do? The banks pull back, and they won't renew other loans, which means other borrowers get into default. And so you get this vicious cycle of defaults. Defaults beget defaults. In 2008, I heard a term that was new to me at the time, and maybe economists have been using this since forever, maybe not, contagion. You know, like it's an infectious disease, like it's a spread of bubonic plague or something like that. Boy, what a perfect storm for other currencies. And so in my view, the dollar will fail last.
Right.
Last, right. After all the other currencies fail first. And of course, the first ones to fail are going to be the marginal ones, the Argentinian pesos of the world and the Turkish liras of the world. And last will be, you know, the dollar in the end.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, redollarization or dollarization absolutely is a real thing.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back. Excited to have Dr. Keith Weiner of Monetary Metals with us again. Last time we dug into what's broken today, we're looking forward at what's changing today, what's emerging, and what it all means for protecting ourselves. Keith, great to have you back, my friend. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
Keith, it feels like every week there's a new macro narrative, de-dollarization, redollarization, soft landing, hard landing. Maybe we need a new term, confused landing. Where do you think we actually are right now? If you can help me make sense of this.
You know, I think the term soft landing needs to be put in context. And, you know, as your viewers may know, and my regular readers know, I've got a different theory of the monetary system than most people. And, you know, in my view, they haven't really resolved anything since at least, you know, let's just say 1971. It's much older than that. And, you know, what's happening certainly since 1981 is the forces are trying to push the interest rate down. And I don't know if I used this analogy the last time I was on your show, but I've used it a few times before. You know, I grew up in what people would call upstate New York. I mean, it was a commuter suburb for the city, but you know, but there were some hills, and it got plenty cold in the winter. And every boy of around that age of, let's just say, 8 years old, has to play around with this. You know, you've seen the cartoons. You know, you roll the snowball gets bigger and bigger and bigger. And it's true, right? You get that good spring snow. It's kind of wet and it's definitely sticky. And you know, you make a snowball and you start pushing it on the ground downhill. Right, and at first the snowball isn't very heavy, and it's a lot of friction to pick up all that additional weight of snow, but eventually it's getting bigger and bigger and bigger, and it starts to roll under its own, you know, weight. And then there's that oh beep moment when you realize that it's not. You can run with it for a while, and maybe you can guide it just slightly, but there's a moment where the thing weighs more than you do as an 8-year-old kid, and only two things are going to govern its fate. Which is, you know, gravity and whatever car, or house, or people are down at the bottom of the hill. And, you know, the interest rate is like that. It's falling since 1981. But every once in a while, the Fed, either for political reasons, I think it's pretty clear that Jay Powell doesn't, like, even though Trump appointed him in his first term, you know, they don't get along. And, you know, Trump wants lower interest rates. Powell wants to dig in his heels. But, you know, whatever the thing is, you know, you talk about macro narratives. Well, we have too much inflation, whatever that means. So they okay, we're going to hike the rate of interest. And I think some of the time realize that it's out of their control, but they want to do it to prove to themselves or maybe to prove to everyone else that they still can. There still actually is a reason to have these monetary masters of the monetary universe, these central planners, whatever it is, they try to hike rates. And what happens is you force the marginal borrowers into default. Because every time it ticked down, the new marginal borrower is somebody whose borrowing only makes sense at that lower rate. And then you try to raise the rate, and then all of that borrowing is now rendered submarginal. It can't be supported. You know, let's say the interest rate's 5%, you own a chain of 172 hamburger restaurants, and you're always looking at the 173rd. And it doesn't make any sense at 5%. You know, the spreadsheet, you know, you calculate your whole model, and the spreadsheet is red ink at the bottom. And then they lower the interest rate to 4%, and ding, you know, the red ink turns to black ink. And so you borrow a couple of $1 million to build this thing. And it only made sense because the rate ticked down. It's not because the demand for hamburgers went up. It's not because your area increased in population to the point where it could support another hamburger restaurant. It's that the interest expense on the new store went down. Right. Now, if they hike the rate, your store is now suddenly non-viable. It's going to go right back to where it came from, which is it can't exist. The problem is if there's a lot of businesses that have borrowed and then you suddenly render them, you know, bankrupt, then that is going to be a lot of defaults that hit the banks. And then you have defaults hitting the banks, so what do? The banks pull back and they won't renew other loans, which means other borrowers get into default. And so you get this vicious cycle of defaults. Defaults beget defaults. In 2008, I heard a term that was new to me at the time, and maybe economists have been using this since forever, maybe not, contagion. You know, like it's an infectious disease, like it's the spread of bubonic plague or something like that. And then it just spreads and spreads and spreads until eventually it would wipe itself out, or if the entire system is over leveraged after 37 years of irredeemable currency and all that, maybe it wouldn't, and it would just wipe out the whole system. So then they have to, I liken the analogy to, you know, there's that the legend of the kid, the Dutch boy, in the dike, and the dike springs a leak, so he plugs it with his finger until the villagers can come and repair it. Now imagine the dike is springing one leak and two leaks and four leaks and 16 leaks and 256 leaks and 16,384 leaks. You know, imagine this army of kids all, you know, plugging the leaks, and that's the central bank trying to fight a 2008 style crisis. And so I think the term soft landing means that they lower the interest rates and they increase, you know, the various monetary spigots and fiscal spigots. The government can spend, and all the extra revenue hits these businesses and props them up. And soft landing is when the government reacts sufficiently big and sufficiently fast to, have too much contagion. And then a hard landing is if they let it go too far, or it's too late by the time they try to jump in, and then that's a hard landing. But both of those are kind of false alternatives, within a larger false alternative. So the first false alternative is, okay, why did you raise the interest rates in an environment where that's mechanically impossible? And then the bigger false alternative is, why do we have irredeemable currency in the first place that necessarily leads to an unstable interest rate that will trend forever and so on. But within that, you know, you have hard and soft as kind of two flavors of bad, you know, depending on, you know, it's what it is, you know, two different flavors for your shit sandwich, I guess, to make an analogy of that.
Or fish ice cream and turkey ice cream.
Did you ever see there was a meme going around? Somebody had Photoshopped Lay's potato chips and created all these really unattractive flavors, orange juice, toothpaste, and that was one that really got me. Couch was another, and was another one that was just really, anyways, it was a whole bunch of them.
Keith, I wanted to get your thoughts on the dollar and dollarization. I read a recent Financial Times piece that painted the Trump team as, you know, pretty much launching a kind of a dollar fight club 2.0. exploring ways to get other countries to adopt the U.S. dollar, basically a global push for re-dollarization. I think the term was pro-dollarization or dollarization. And Professor Steve Hanke thinks we're more likely to see a world re-dollarize than de-dollarize. Keith, what's your take on that? Are we moving away from the dollar back towards it, moving into a multi-currency world? Where's the dollar going?
I differ from most folks in the gold community in that I, long before Trump and this particular episode, I have been in the dollarization camp. And I have a couple of litmus tests. The first, I call it the taxi driver test. Suppose you take a taxi somewhere and you offer the guy dollars, even though, some other country where they don't use dollars. Is the dollar going to be rejected? Is there going to be anger? Will he take it happily with a smile? And I think a lot of people realize if you go to some place where they have some benighted peso, the Banana Republic, and you offer them dollars, of course they're happy to take it, which is part of the story, right? That's the places where dollarization will happen. It happened to me in Switzerland. I took a taxi. Now, I normally get by a credit card. I don't generally go and bring a whole bunch of dollar cash and then go to the airport and the currency exchange place and trade it for local cash. Too much of a pain in the butt, and everybody pretty much takes credit cards nowadays. Everybody except this particular taxi that I got in Switzerland. Cash only, and I was like in a real bind. Now, the fare was 20.2 francs. At that time, the franc was, I think, $1.03 or $1.06. So that was a bit over $20.
Yeah.
And all I had was a couple of $20 bills. So I took out a $20 bill, which is a little bit short of the fare. But that's really all I had. And it was like, I was kind of in a bind. Anyway, he smiled and he was so happy to take the $20 bill. This is Switzerland, which is supposedly the best paper currency, right? Well, he was happy to take dollars, even at a bit of a discount relative to what the fare was. I think the world is absolutely, the big population countries. You think India, China, to name two. Turkey's not that small. Brazil, definitely not that small. They have capital controls. Brazil, a little bit less so. Officially they don't, but if you really want to take, $1 million out, you're going to find you can't. They lock their people in to the currency. Now, what is that telling you? And the people there all want dollars, not allowed. And in China, they risk their lives. I mean, when they hire, like in the U.S., when you hire an financial advisor, if you're a client at a big bank, hire a wealth advisor. That guy's job is to really sort of, it's like half marriage counselor and half portfolio allocator. It's like, okay, how old are you? And, what are your goals? And how much you think you're going to be making, not only this year, but the next 10, 20 years? And, okay, we think you should have this much in bonds and this much in equities, a little bit of real estate, whatever. And in China, that's also their job. But a big overlay of that is they help you navigate the capital controls. Uh-huh. Everybody in China of any degree of wealth is trying to dump their yuan and get dollars. And it's illegal. Now, in a place like that, when you break a law like that, if they catch you, it's not like, okay, $10,000, fine. It's like they can disappear you to secret prison and beat you within an inch of your life. I mean, bad things can happen. And they're all risking it to dump their yuan and get dollars. And I think that the government there is terrified what would happen to the value of the yuan if the people were allowed to dump as much of it as they wanted to. So I think this has been going on for a long time. And then you look at India and Turkey. Now, India is not a hyperinflationary case at the moment. It's just a regular inflationary case where, the rupee goes down, I think it's 8% per annum against the dollar. And it's not like the dollar is going up against anything real. In Turkey, it is on and off threatening hyperinflation. Right. And people absolutely, if they could, would have more dollars. So they can't, they buy gold, they do all these things, right? Now, I think what the story is referring to is dollar stable coins. And it's much harder for a government to block a crypto token because that's the nature of crypto, is it's an end run around certainly banking system regulation, central bank regulation, right? You buy what you want. And I think what's going to happen is if dollar stablecoin tokens become widely available in places like Turkey, like India, like China, there will be a heck of a lot of capital that drains out of the currency and into the dollar. Boy, what a perfect storm for other currencies. And so in my view, the dollar will fail last.
Right.
After all the other currencies fail first. And of course, the first ones to fail are going to be the marginal ones, the Argentinian pesos of the world and the Turkish liras of the world. And last will be, the dollar in the end.
Mm-hmm.
Redollarization or dollarization absolutely is a real thing.
Keith, do you see the U.S. actually succeeding to nudge countries like Argentina to dollarize? And if the dollar's strength grows globally, what does that mean domestically and abroad? And how does it affect gold? Does a stronger dollar weaken gold or make gold even more important?
So I'll take the second part first. I argue that measuring the dollar in terms of the other currencies is a bit like measuring Apple by Apple call options. Apple went up 20% today because it takes 120 Apple call options to buy a share of Apple, and it used to take only 100 Apple call options.
Yeah.
The other currencies are dollar derivatives. You're measuring it exactly backwards. Mm-hmm. But even if you look at the other currencies as going down rather than the dollar going up, I don't really see that necessarily being correlated to the price of gold in dollars, which is also inverted. It really should be the price of dollar in gold, 7.5 milligrams or whatever it is right now. Every dollar, it takes 7.5 milligrams of gold to buy a dollar is really how we should look at it. And I don't think those two really necessarily correlated. The first part of your question was about higher dollar relative to the other currencies. What does that do? So here's the challenge. If you are a substantial corporation, whether you're in Turkey, India, China, wherever, the funding market will be happy to lend you dollars, if you're creditworthy, but not so much the local currency because people don't want to take the local currency risk, which means you have dollar debts. Right, so the dollar is reserve currency because people hold it in reserve, not because the transactions happen to be denominated in dollars. Yes, it's true. When oil is sold, it's mm-hmm. denominated in dollars. But more importantly, all the mm-hmm. oil producers have dollar debt. If you are a producer of, you're a baker, a big baker in India, and you bake bread. And, the dollar goes up, which means the rupee goes down. Your revenues are in rupees. You're selling bread to Indians, and they're paying in rupees. So your mm-hmm. revenue is going down in dollar terms, and yet your debt is fixed in dollar terms. That's a squeeze. You are getting absolutely squeezed. Mm-hmm. And the rest of the world, experiences real pain when this happens. And so there's kind of a perversity. On the one hand, the dollar's on the asset side of their balance sheet, especially for the central banks. And they hate it when the dollar goes down relative to the local currency. There was somebody, I think this was France, was arguing with, the U.S. delegation and Treasury Secretary at the time, Connolly, and said, your dollar is a very big problem. It's going down, and it's hurting us, blah, 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 blah. And Secretary Connolly was smirking, and he said, well, it's our dollar, but it's your problem. They hate it when it goes down, but when it goes up, it's even worse because it squeezes their, all the debtors into default.
Right.
And so, again, it's kind of a false alternative. Do you want the wrecking ball on the north side of the street knocking around buildings there? Or do you want the wrecking ball on the south side of the street taking down the buildings over there? It isn't really good when it moves around, and this is the collapse of Bretton Woods and Milton Friedman's regime of so-called floating currencies, where they don't really float, they all sink at different rates. But every time one overtakes another, that's causing real pain somewhere. And Americans look at it and say, well, that's great. The British pound is down. I can go take a vacation in London. It's cheaper than it was. Well, yeah. But that's somebody's savings has been devalued, number one. And number two, there's businesses with dollar debt struggling to pay their debts over there. And that means that they're not paying dividends. They just have real problems.
So I had Doug Casey here, and he was saying that we're pretty much already, on one hand, he said that we are already in a war, or we're on the verge of a war. It's kind of, he kind of teetered between those. But in, if there was a war going on, is it a currency war? Is it an attempt to dump the yuan and to de-dollarize and to bring control away, take control away from the U.S. And is U.S. pretty much trying to trying to look good by rescuing Argentina? And yes, I'm sure it'll be good for Argentina to delay the crisis and turmoil. But is it, you know, what's the U.S. trying to achieve here? Is it stability, leverage, control? And you also mentioned stable coin. You know, is that the tool they're going to use for it? What should we be watching for?
You know, I try to keep separate kind of the aims and goals of whichever crop of politicians temporarily happen to be in office versus kind of the inexorable play out of the monetary system, which I regard as kind of like plate tectonics. It doesn't always move that fast, but nobody is going to stop it. When the Los Angeles plate, you know, wants to move, you know, the San Andreas Fault wants to shift, like, you're not going to drop a nuclear bomb. There's nothing you can do to stop it, right?
All right.
I think that, you know, U.S. policy has never really been particularly coherent on this stuff. And sometimes it depends on how you frame the question. You know, if you frame it, you know, should we let them get one over on us by this? Then all of a sudden it's like, no, we want our currency to go up. But then if you frame it the other way, you know, what about all this cheap imports flooding the country? Then, you know, people will go the other way. So they can alternatively be scared by the specter that all these foreign investors are buying up our housing stock or our stocks or whatever it is. And on the other hand, you know, dumping exports onto us. And all of that is very temporary in nature and often based on, you know, multiple economic fallacies all stacked up. So I don't see a particularly coherent strategy. I think, you know, and I really want to stay in my swim lane, which is monetary economics. But if I read the bailout of Argentina, it's like, you know, Trump is looking at Milei cozying up to him as a friend versus Mark Carney and Canada, whom he regards as an enemy. And so he wants to reward his friend and punish his enemy. And is there really a long-term strategy to that? If there is one, I certainly don't see it. But in any case, the system is going to play out the way it is because it's wired in a certain way. And regardless of what Trump wants or anyone else wants, you know, Powell, whoever the next, you know, Fed chair is going to be, you know, in 2026, it doesn't really matter what they want because it works the way it works. And, you know, is the Argentinian peso done? Does that can have one good kick left in it? Very hard to say. And usually these things, these cans have more kicks left in them than you would think. You would think, man, that is so done. you know, I mean, people have been talking about shorting the Japanese yen for decades. It's called the widowmaker's trade, right? That by all logic, that currency should be toast. And yet, it, you know, keeps coming back with a renewed lease. Now, you know, in recent years, it really has slipped quite a bit. And it went from 70 or 80 yuan to the dollar, basically double that, 150. So maybe that is the beginning, you know, really crumbling. But these things take a long time. There's more aces up their sleeves than you might think. You know, there's greater resiliency, especially in a currency that's borrowed as much as the yen. Right? So people think that they think in very linear terms, quantity theory of money, you know, if you double the quantity of currency units, you double, you have each one of them is worth half. You double again, it's worth half again. They don't realize that it's not printed, it's borrowed. And as soon as you realize it's borrowed, you realize that now the borrowers have a built-in demand. The currency, they make a ferocious bid because otherwise they're inside, you know, the bank takes their farm or their business or their house. People don't want to allow that, so they will do almost anything to avoid that. And, you know, if you think about how much demand, so let's say you borrow, $1 million to buy a house. How much demand does that represent for dollars just from you personally? It's a heck of a lot more than $1 million. And so that's the nature of, so the more debt there is, which is the more currency units, the more borrowers there are demanding it more ferociously. And so it doesn't work in the way that people assume. But eventually, in the end, all that debt can't be serviced, and that's when the collapse happens.
Speaking of buying house, Trump floated the idea of a 50-year mortgage. What's your take on that? A 50-year mortgage.
I saw a thing on this. I don't know if it's true, that he was at his golf club in I think in Florida, and the housing secretary Bill Pulte, showed him a poster saying two great presidents, Roosevelt creating the 30-year mortgage, Trump creating the 50-year mortgage. He's like, that's great. Took a picture of it and posted to Truth Social, and now we have a new mortgage policy. The first comment that has to be made, we shouldn't have financial instruments at the whim of the president. Whether you like the president or not, whether you think his policies are good or not, man, we should have a market in this stuff. Let the market figure out how long the mortgage should be. That's the first thing. The second thing is that it's a sign that there's a real affordability problem, that the marginal difference, right? If you do the math, going from a 30-year mortgage to a 50-year mortgage doesn't lower the payment all that much, but it does lower it a little bit. And for somebody who's just marginal, just on the borderline, whether they can afford the payment in that house or not, yes, it does make a difference. And then if you look at how much interest they're going to pay over the life of the loan, it's massively higher on the 50-year amortization schedule versus the 30-year amortization schedule. So if we're at the point where the only way that people can make the payment is by extending the maturity to 50 years, that's not a good sign. That's not a healthy sign. But that represents one more good kick to that can. Like people say, well, the housing market is no place to go. It has to topple over. And then, boom, enter 50-year mortgages, which presumably will be conforming according to Fannie and Freddie, basically government subsidies, where the government will guarantee this mortgage. And therefore, there's a market for that paper that otherwise would not exist if the government weren't stepping in and guaranteeing it. Then, sure, now you have a market in 50-year mortgages, and away we go, and that creates a whole nother bid in the housing market, and housing prices go higher, which is great if you want to sell a house. Not so great if you're trying to buy your first one, because then you're even more locked out than ever before. But if you're a bank and you have a lot of mortgage paper on the asset side of your balance sheet, now you're safe for another X number of years while this builds up until everyone is essentially on 50-year mortgages, and then the crisis returns. But by then, if you're the CEO of a bank today, you hope to be cashed out, retired on a golf course, and it becomes somebody else's problem. Wonderful stuff,
I
right?
mean, how far can we kick it? I mean, it's like he said 15 or 30-year mortgage and then 50. And it's like, I mean, I don't know how long the human lifespan is, but it's like it's at some point the mortgage is the you're talking about exceeding human lifespans. Like where people are going to never own a house, and then it's going to like be we're going to keep getting debt where it's going to be a 70-year mortgage is next. It's like they're trying to keep the system afloat. I mean, do you see this as an indication of, deeper systemic issues here?
Yeah, we've perverted the notion of investing. Investing at its base, at its, the basis of investing is to finance new production, either increased production of an existing thing or production of a whole new thing. And because you finance that production, that, first of all, number one, that producer makes money, and the investor is paid part of the profits that come from that new production. That's what investing is. We perverted that through, essentially a century of Keynesianism to investing is betting, speculating, going into the casino with a chip, putting it down on red number eight, spinning that wheel. And, if it comes in, now you have, 25 chips rather than one chip. And, whether it's betting on, Bitcoin, whether it's betting on properties, whether it's betting on aged whiskey, whether it's betting on stocks, or betting on homes, it's betting. And the profit is suppose you're successfully betting, you know, you make a bet and it works. The profit comes not from any kind of increased production, but it comes out of the capital, out of the savings of the next bettor.
Right.
The next guy who wants to make the bet is coming in after you. And so we've turned homes into, you know, chips in the Fed's casino. And the 50-year mortgage is the next, you know, kick of that can. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the whole thing's perverted. And homes are not affordable, especially if you're a first-time home. Now, if you have a home already and you're selling it, trading for another one, you're already in, and, you know, you lose a bit off for spread to real estate commission and other things, but you already have a home, you have a capital asset, you're trading for another capital asset. Regardless of how high they go, you're okay. It's somebody who doesn't have one yet, mm-hmm. because they're 23 years old, they've been out of university for 2 years, they have a decent salary, mm-hmm. and they're looking at the prices of houses saying, there's no way, it's hopeless. And you never want whole generations to feel it's hopeless. I think that's just a horrible place to be. And of course, one of the ways they express that hopelessness is they vote for outright communists like Mamdani in New York City.
I mean, where are we with debt right now? We're over to $34 trillion. I mean, I can't even conceive of $1 trillion, let alone 34. Numbers.
What's it, 37 or 38 right now?
38. Numbers that big are just, impossible to grasp. You know, the old saying goes, loss of faith in currency happens slowly, then all at once. What might that loss of faith look like in practice? Is there a point or a number? I mean, if we're at 38 trillion or 37, 38 trillion, I mean, is 39 trillion all that more different? I mean, is that the mentality that we have? Is there a number where we go, all right, that's the magic number, or are we never going to see the number and it's something else? What's going to tip the system into a crisis here?
I think, one sense you could say, okay, that camel is really strong and putting one more straw on its back, mm-hmm. Couldn't possibly hurt it, right? And one more straw, and one more straw, and one more straw. Yeah, there is a limit. But in a modern monetary system, and I should put modern in scare quotes because this is really not modern in any proper sense, not progress anyway. The limit is really the ability, the capacity to service the debt. The amount of debt per se doesn't really mean anything. And of course, you'd have to calculate as a ratio of debt to something, debt to productive capacity, debt to equity. Mm-hmm. But the problem is you can't measure equity because as the interest rate falls, the net present value calculation to measure the value of assets double in value every halving of the interest rate. Mm-hmm. So the whole thing's completely distorted. How would you even, but conceptually, if I told you I had $1 million worth of debt, you don't know whether I'm super rich or whether I'm broke beyond all belief until you know what my assets are. So if I said that I own a business that produces $1 billion in profit per year and I have $1 million worth of short-term liability on the balance sheet, that's great. If I said that I was a consumer making $79,000 a year and I have $1 million worth of debt and no asset, say your ass is broke, file for bankruptcy because there's no other way out for you. So it's the same thing with the economy. What's the capacity of the national economy? We got to look at the ability to service debt. And unfortunately, they have a trick every time the ability to service debt is called into question, and that trick is the interest rate goes down. And now, right, so it takes less monthly, the monthly payment to service the debt goes down.
Right.
On most of the debt. I mean, mortgages are fixed, kind of unique in the U.S. Monetary system and unique globally. That U.S. Mm-hmm. mortgages are generally, most of them are generally fixed for long duration. It's not true in most of the rest of the world, and certainly mm-hmm. not true for business debt. So every time the debt rolls, a business might have a portfolio of different, liabilities. They might have some short-term loans, and they have some vendor, working capital, and they have some short-term bonds and medium-term bonds. Very little of it would probably extend much beyond, 5 years, which mm-hmm. means if the interest rates go up and stay up for 5 years, it all rolls over at higher, you know, let's say the interest rate is falling, it goes to a lower rate, and that means seemingly it eases the burden. And that's what central banks focus on, is okay, we can lower the payment. And now when this at this higher debt level, we can afford the payment just fine. Of course, there's other problems. It becomes harder to obtain the revenue at those lower interest rates because you're subsidizing so many new competitors who suddenly their business model, their spreadsheet goes from red ink to black ink, and everybody's building more capacity. And suddenly then, you know, the ability to service the debt decreases, and then they have to lower the interest rate again. And so that's one way they keep kicking and kicking and kicking that can. Now, when you get to zero, what happens? And a lot of economists, you know, talk about the zero bound. I'm not a big fan. I think if your economic theory has some magic line or some magic number, and everything up until and just touching the edge of that line is okay, and everything beyond the edge of that line is foul, like, you know, like a tennis player hits the ball in tennis. And now, you know, you want a microscope to see whether it was on the line or over the line or whatever. I don't really think economics works that way. Change happens at the margin. It's gradual. But obviously something happens at the zero bound. I think people realize that if you pay the borrower what we call money, it's not money, it's credit. But if you pay the borrower to be in debt, there's something very screwy about that. I think, like... You don't need a PhD in economics to realize it's screwy. And so the zero bound is a place where it's not that anything magically changes in the economy, but rather the problem becomes too obvious for anyone to pretend it's okay anymore. At 0.01%, they can pretend it's fine. It's not fine, but they can pretend it's fine. They can, you know, what is it? Not listening, la, la, la. They can pretend it's not there, but at minus 0.01%, there's something screwy about it. And so, you know, but in my view, every time you lower the interest rate, you're consuming capital. And the capital consumption does change character at a negative interest rate. That means that the business is consuming, let's say you're borrowing at minus 1%. I'm sorry, let's say you're borrowing at minus 2%. The business can destroy its capital base at a rate of minus 1% per annum. But if its cost of capital is minus 2%, it actually writes a profit on its P&L. And there's something very screwy about that I think is more obvious than, if the only reason why the business is profit is because the interest rate is 0.01, you're doing the same thing. It's just less blatant. It's less in your face, you know. I guess it's like the difference between the alcoholic who, you know, goes to work every day and he sits in his office and he has booze concealed in what looks like a thermos of coffee. And, you know, some alcoholics have it really well masked where, you know, they don't become loud and boisterous. They don't become irrational. Right. They've learned how to walk in a way that compensates for being drunk, so they're not like staggering all over the place, right? And they can keep their voice sounding coherent, they don't slur their words. And so that alcoholic maybe might keep a job for decades like that. And then you give him one more drink and he goes over the edge of whatever his ability is to compensate for the booze, right? And now suddenly it becomes obvious. And if he gets fired and, you know, everything in his life blows up and he hits rock bottom, he's lying there in the gutter. It's kind of like that. So anyways, we can lower the interest rate, extend people's or businesses' particular ability to service the debt for a while, and then when you get to zero, it creates all these existential questions that people would rather not think about. And they'll find some SOPA fork, they'll find some way to tamp that down, and well, it's okay because, you know, they'll coin some new terminology, you know, there'll be very reassuring voices. It won't be Janet Yellen. I think she's kind of aging out, and other crazy MMT people. Maybe it'll be Stephanie Kelton, you know, the MMT, lady, whoever it'll be. You know, it's okay, it's fine, and you know, look, GDP is up, and you know, the economy created 172,000 new jobs last quarter, and you know, to sort of tamp down that desire to even recognize the problem, let alone fix it.
Using your analogy of the drunkard who is trying to hide his lack of sobriety or lack of composure, is there a way, is that what the US is trying to do with the 30-year mortgage, to just kind of hide the issue, to mask the issue? And is there a way where he can get out of it? I mean, is where he doesn't have to stop pretending. Is like, can he undrunk himself? It's like, I've read, Trump floated around the idea of using Bitcoin to pay off the national debt. Now, I'm no math genius, but I don't think the math is mathing very well. Do you see the US realistically? Yeah. Go
The first
ahead.
thing I'd like to do, and this is unconventional, which is sad because it should be the first thing everybody asks.
He
What's the mechan like
unconventional?
break that down for me at a mechanical level. Like if you wanted to describe this as a process that okay, first this party does this, then
Yeah.
this party does this, and this third party does this, and therefore this happens. Like break that down. Like how do you use, is it okay, we're gonna buy Bitcoin, wait for the price to go up and then sell it, and it's gonna go up by $38 trillion, and we're gonna sell it and without crashing the market and pay off the debt. There isn't even a mechanics that even make any sense to me for that. There's every once in a while, and it seems to take a long time. So in the was it 1628 or something like that, was the tulip bubble in Holland, if I remember the date right.
Yeah.
And then it was like a century later, and you had the John Law episode with Mississippi. The Mississippi Company, Mississippi, I forget what it was called, Mississippi something, the bubble in France. And
Yeah.
in the early 19th century, you had other hyperinflations in France. 20th century, obviously Weimar Germany, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And like people, forget some basic timeless economic lessons. And then have to repeat it all over again.
Yeah.
And the idea that an entire society can get rich because an asset price is going up, or that it, for that matter, lots of asset prices going up, should be at this point rock solid economics that there's, the understanding of this should be clear. There's been enough of these episodes that whole generations, whole societies cannot get rich by an asset price going up. Yes, an individual speculator certainly can, or maybe even obviously a group of speculators can, but it can't be, large enough because the scheme, the pyramid require, there's the one guy at the top, and then there's two, and then there's four, and there's 16, and there's 250.
Yeah.
Eventually, you run out of people in society on that pyramid,
Yeah.
and that's the thing that okay, to think the U.S. government is going to pay off anything by buying Bitcoin. I think the only thing that can happen, and people who read my Twitter feed know that I'm not a fan of Bitcoin at all. This is the search for the next buyer to provide the exit liquidity for the people that have been speculating on it and would love to sell it at $1 million or whatever they think the price that they, if the U.S. Treasury was buying in size, it obviously would drive the price up. And so, because the government is handing out, free money. And it's not free, as we know. There's a cost to this, but they're handing out free money, and anybody who buys a Bitcoin to front run that trade is going to make out like a bandit. So that's what they want. That's pretty obvious, pretty simple. But that anybody would take this seriously as a means of creating wealth, not simply transferring or taking wealth and redistributing it, to use a word from the other side of the aisle for a minute, and to view this as anything other than a means of redistribution. And try to say, well, this is, this is actually going to be a net economic good for the country, as such, and for society as a whole. It's just, it's so preposterous that it's a frivolous idea that has no merit, even worth even debating.
Key, last time you were on here, I do want to go back to the interview just for a moment. You talked about having a different view on hyperinflation. If you can just give us the context on that a little bit. I think you mentioned something about the dollar and the gold and, what really happens in a crisis. If you can, flesh that out for us a little bit more.
Yeah, sure. I think what I was probably referring to was, you know, people think, and I've heard, you know, really smart people, like speakers at conferences, talk about that, you know, normally in a crisis, it's the bid that's withdrawn. You know, if there's, if the U.S. Geological Survey said there's going to be an earthquake in L.A., 15 on the Richter scale, nothing taller than a dollhouse would be left standing. What you would find is no bids on real estate. There'll be plenty of offers. Lots of people would be happy to sell, and those offers would be all over the map. Some of them would be discounts from what you think of the price of real estate in L.A. today, but there'll be no bids. Probably from Santiago, Chile, all the way up to British Columbia and Canada, maybe as far east as the Mississippi River, there'd be no bid. As the whole market holds their breath, waiting for the earthquake, and then after the earthquake, the bid will come back in. So it's the bid that disappears under threat or crisis. Mm-hmm. And I've heard people talk about that, smart people, not idiots, who say that gold is different. It's gold, the offer it goes off the board, not the bid. Mm-hmm. Gold is the thing people want in that crisis of that sort. You know, people want their gold. And so the offer withdraws. And so gold is different from everything else in the economic universe. Now, as a guy who thinks of monetary economics as a science, that bothers me. Why in the world should this one thing be different in that in that sense? And different how, and what would make it different? And then when you realize you're looking at things inside out, it becomes so much clearer, because then you can revert it, right? So before Galileo, before Copernicus, they thought that all the planets and the sun revolved around the Earth. And then to try to understand the motion of some of the other planets was incomprehensible, because you had what they called retrograde motion, right? I mean, you had Mercury would go forward a bit and then backwards and then forward some more and backwards. And this is like, it's hard to even write the equation to even describe the path of the motion, let alone come up with a theory to explain what would make it go backwards. But when you realize that actually the Earth and Mercury are both going around the sun, and the apparent retrograde motion of Mercury is just an artifact of the fact that we're observing it from the Earth, which is also going around the sun at a different rate and a different radius, then it becomes very simple. And so what I say is, you can't understand gold by thinking of its price in dollar terms. Well, gold's going to go up anymore. You know, it's at 4,400, it's come back down, and, you know, it's going to go up. You have to understand that it's gold is the money, and the dollar is the credit instrument. And the dollar has been falling. The dollar was over 1,500 milligrams of gold to buy $1 in 1913. And hit a low just a hair under 7 milligrams. A month ago or whatever that was, so when we hit the peak of the gold price, excuse me. And now, you know, it's come back up and we're at 7.5 or something now. When you realize that gold is the money, therefore gold is bidding on the dollar, that's how it's actually going, then you realize that in a time of crisis, gold will withdraw its bid on the dollar. That principle that in crisis, bids are withdrawn, never offers, will hold true. Gold is not any different. It's just that gold is making the bid on the dollar. And if you think of it as the dollar making its bid on gold, or gold is making an offer, whatever, it's confusion, it's retrograde motion, and you're stuck and you can't get out of it. So I think that the so-called, we'll call it hyperinflation when it happens, but when gold withdraws its bid on the dollar, then prices will skyrocket, and consumer prices, commodity prices will skyrocket to infinity. People will say that was it, that was the tipping point. And yeah, there's a tipping point of sorts, but not in the quantity of dollars, but rather the unsoundness. So my definition of inflation has nothing to do with the quantity of something. It has to do with the counterfeiting. We're calling it borrowing, but when the borrower has neither the means nor the intent to ever repay, that's not actually borrowing. That's back in college, there was always that one guy that would be like bumming everything off of everybody. Can I bum a cigarette? Can I bum this? Can I bum that? And he would couch surf. I remember that term, because he didn't have a place to live. And can you give me a ride here? And can you do this? And he was always begging and mooching and maybe stealing if you left your wallet on the table and he saw that you weren't in the room, he'd steal a 20 out of it. And then he says, can you spot me $100? You knew that if you gave him $100, you weren't getting it back. And maybe he's a good enough friend. A lot of people do that sort of thing, and you know, whatever. But it's not borrowing. It's taking and consuming, right? And so too much, a greater and greater proportion of what we call borrowing today isn't really borrowing. It's counterfeit credit in that it's not possible for it to ever be repaid. And so when the counterfeit credit becomes greater and greater and the legitimate credit becomes shrinking, certainly as proportion, then the system is becoming more and more unsound. It's the unsoundness rather than the quantity of anything per se that caused a collapse in ultimately confidence, where gold withdraws its bid on the dollar, and that's the end, you know, of the system. I don't know
Keith,
if that
think about
kind of a complicated
gold.
Idea, but...
I think what you said last time was like people take the profit on gold and then you know go back to the dollar that they said it was useless, and you know we still think of the dollar as the money, and for
right.
you to put gold as the money is a paradigm shift or a Copernicus revolution or a Galileo or whatever you want to call it. So, having said that, could you tell us a little bit about monetary metals, what you're doing, what that's all about?
We're all about paying interest on the gold, in gold. And so there's never, you don't have that need, right? So the ironic observation that I make, maybe I should say sardonic observation, as people rightly recognize there's a problem, the dollar is defective in some really gross way. Mm-hmm. So they buy gold. Okay, that's, you know, that's right. You should buy some, everybody should buy some gold. If you're listening to this and you don't have any gold, go out and buy a few coins and stick it in your sock drawer. At least you have a few, if something. But then a funny thing happens along the way, which is now they have the gold, they're cheering for its price to rise. Why? Well, if it goes up enough, then they sell it to get more of the very dollars that they just thought were going to shit. Now they buy more of the dollars, but they have more of them, so they're happy. And but the problem is deeper than that, and not to pick on anybody who falls into this trap. The problem is if you buy gold and you never, ever sell it, you have no mm-hmm. way of profiting from your gold. You could be right, and the gold price goes to whatever, $20,000. You could be right, but you can't profit from it except by selling it.
Yeah.
And you know, I think we're entering an environment now where more and more people actually intend not to sell it because they don't want, they do get at least the first part of this dilemma. They don't want more dollar exposure, even if it's a higher dollar price of gold. But then what do you do? Well, if you can earn interest on the gold, now you can profit from it without having to sell it. And that's our value proposition. Now, we're trying to do something more than that. We are, first of all, providing a finance solution to businesses that are real businesses doing something real in the economy. And we're trying to bring back gold as a monetary, you know, instrument and not just mm-hmm. as this dry, you know, thing. You have this lump of metal sitting there, as Warren Buffett refers to it, in your desk drawer. Or more likely, you have this bar of metal in your safe or in a professional depository, where it's useless and it's gathering dust. And everyone mm-hmm. realizes it's useless, and that's why a lot of people don't like to buy it, because it just feels counterproductive. And that's certainly mm-hmm. Warren Buffett's argument. But if you're putting it to work, then what will happen is gold will come into the market, will come out of all these private hiding places into the market, where it can begin to not first finance business, secondly pay interest to, you know, savers, and then thirdly begin to circulate. And interest is the key to circulation. So we have a longer-term, you know, vision of where we're trying to get to, which is to bring gold back and give people a monetary alternative to the dollar, and interest is the key to the whole thing. So that's our ethos and our value proposition all wrapped into one.
So you basically created the solution to the people who object that gold doesn't have any yield. All it does is it stacks and it doesn't work for you. Question for you is, who borrows the gold, and you know, how's it used? If you can help us understand the concept just a little bit.
So we have two programs that both achieve the same proposition of interest on gold or yield on gold, but done in different ways. The primary one, the big one right now, is leasing. So think of a jewelry store. Not so much the jewelry stores in the West; they don't really have all that much gold. But a jewelry store in the East. You know, a jewelry store could have 50 kilos of gold. That's like $6 million of gold. And that has to be financed somehow. So they get that gold on lease, where the participants in our program, the owners of the gold, own, they're swapping their gold bars in a vault for the jewelry in the store with, mm-hmm. you know, security and monitoring and insurance and all the other stuff. But they own those, you know, earrings and pendants and rings and all that stuff. And now allowing the jeweler to turn that over, though the jeweler's operating his business, making money as a jewelry store, and the investors mm-hmm. who own the gold are making a rental or a lease fee, an interest payment on their gold, and they still have their gold. So to have your cake and eat it too, you know, proposition. Yeah. The other is lending. And lending is for businesses that don't have a gold inventory, but have a gold income. So think of mining companies, although there will be industrials, you know, as well. A mining company doesn't have gold bars. The moment they produce the gold bar, they sell it. That's the business model of a miner. Mm-hmm. But if they have a gold income, they literally create gold from rock. And right. So when they borrow, whatever, let's say $50 million to build a mine, they could borrow it as denominated in dollars. And the problem is if the gold price drops, they have an asset liability mismatch. It becomes harder and harder to service the debt. Or if they borrow it in gold, now mm-hmm. the liability matches the asset, takes out that risk for them, and they're happy to repay because they know how many ounces of gold they can produce. They just don't know the dollar price, what that gold will be in 3 years when they're able to repay the loan. So we will do that loan, but denominated in gold. We parcel that out as a securities offering that we call a gold bond. That is limited to accredited investors only, so we don't generally, most of those we don't advertise. But unfortunately, securities regulation being what it is. You know, that is lending of gold to businesses that have, you know, gold income.
Keith, for anyone who's interested in diving deeper and learning about how to earn a gold yield, what's the best way to follow you, reach out to you, get started, and if you can also give your website?
So I was at the website, which is where all the information about the product, the services, how that all works, to get in touch. That's monetary-metals.com. And then if you want to follow me personally on Twitter, I'm at Real Keith Weiner. That's KeithWeiner. There are imposters that love to sit on misspellings of my names.
Keith, I really appreciate your time and insights. It's a privilege to have you back. I'm forever in debt, and not just in dollars. For everyone listening, I'll include Keith's link for Monetary Metals in the show notes. I'm Steve Yang, learning alongside you from people smarter than me. Stay smart, stay curious, stay disciplined. Keith, thanks again.
Thanks for having me, Steve.